On the 26th of November, 1922, the archaeologist Howard Carter wrote in his diary in Egypt the following words. He said, "With trembling hands I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner of the door. Widening the hole a little, I inserted a candle and peered in. At first I could see nothing, the hot air escaping from the chamber causing the candle to flicker. Presently details of the room emerged slowly from the mist, strange animals, statues and gold. Everywhere the glint of gold. For the moment, an eternity it must have seemed to the others standing by, I was struck dumb with amazement. And when Lord Carnarvon, unable to stand in suspense any longer, inquired anxiously, 'Can you see anything?' It was all I could do to get out the words, 'Yes, wonderful things.'" So I've gone down in history, yes, wonderful things, the tomb of Tutankhamun, and the initial view of what was actually in the tomb itself is Howard Carter was looking in the tomb. But you think back about 3,000 years before, when King Tut, as it became known, actually got all this wealth and started planning his funeral, planning his journey into the afterlife. And all the elaborate precautions were taken to stop the tomb robbers from getting in there. And all the things that he did in order to preserve his life, or preserve his wealth. And even though he was going on the other side, as far as he was concerned. And then think 1,000 years into the future from now, when he actually comes up with nothing, with absolutely nothing. You won't even have the clothes he was standing in. You'd have to probably be given clothes to start the life. But that life, in fact, you and I, you know, whether we will actually be there for him himself, but he will be risen at the same time as perhaps slaves that have built his tomb. And he'll be on an equal footing with them. And you and I are then going to have to explain to him something about true riches. What true riches are all about. Because he'll have just gone through a financial crash. You talk about a financial crash. I mean, you look at the wealth of Tutankhamun's tomb, and he comes up with absolutely nothing. It's a crash of all crashes. And yet today, we stand on the precipice economically. And Mr. Armstrong, over in his sermon on Prophecy, part one, over in July 1984, just about 4 minutes into this sermon, he says, "I can now see the event that's going to trigger the formation of a reunification of Europe, the resurrection of the medieval Holy Roman Empire that we've been looking forward to, that is prophesied to come. I believe that some event is going to happen suddenly, just out of a clear blue sky, that's going to shock the whole world and is going to cause the nations of Europe to realize that they must unite. Well, now I think I can see what that may be, the very event that's going to trigger it, and that is the economic situation in the world." Now, he was looking at a world economic situation which is to do with Argentina and South America, and the fact that these loans had been made by these banks to these South American countries, defaulting on the loans, and you could see this having an escalating effect on all the banking within the world, quite frankly. It's not that South America is going to cause the problem, looking at it today, but we're using the same spirit that Mr. Armstrong looked at the situation at that time to look at our world today, and looking at the same spirit, we've got quantitative easing, we've got, you know, negative interest rates, and so many things are pointing in the direction of a financial crash. And what I'd like to do today is I want to just talk about some of the lessons that God expects us to learn, because we're going to have to teach people about financial crashes, Tutankhamun being one of the key individuals in the future. And the economic events that are about to come on this world, we are going to have to learn from. It appears that we'll be living through a certain, whether we live through the major ones, you know, what's the major? We're not going to live, hopefully we're not going to live through the Great Tribulation. But the initial lead up to that Great Tribulation, as Mr. Armstrong said, the trigger seems to be financial. it's going to be global, it's going to be financial. And so I'd like to go into some of the lessons that God expects us to learn through such an occurrence, and show how it contrasts, quite frankly, with the loss of the money supply, how it'll contrast with the true riches that God offers all mankind, because that's what we're going to have to learn, because we're going to have to teach it. We have to teach it to other people. We have to teach a different way of life. So instead of a way of getting for ourselves, which the world is entirely based on, it's a case of giving, of a world that's based on the way of giving. So I want to talk a little bit about the present position, first of all, and just read a few quotes regarding that present position. Secondly, I want to talk about money as a worldly illusion, because it really is. Fiat money is an illusion. It's an illusion of wealth. It's not what God intends, not the way we've got it today. Thirdly, I want to talk about the prophesied direction, what is actually prophesied regarding the financial crash that's coming in, what's prophesied regarding the economies as far as God is concerned. And fourthly, I want to talk about God's physical wealth, because God does expect us to manage physical wealth and to look after that side of our lives. And also, finally, I want to talk about God's spiritual wealth, because that is crucial. That's what we really need to get to grips with. Now, the present position that we find ourselves in, within that particular transcript, within that particular sermon on Prophecy Part 1, back in July 84, Mr. Armstrong makes some comments about the banking system and what, in fact, the way the banking system came into being, having made the startling statements about the fact that he reckons it's going to be the trigger. Well, what started the whole edifice that we've got today? And he said, now we had to have an economic system as specialization progressed, and to handle money and the transfer of money from one person to another, a banking system was originated. Now today you've been born into a world where you take banks for granted. There have been banks for now hundreds and hundreds, and I guess even thousands of years, perhaps. But banks have to deal with one another, and transportation has increased, and some people live in different parts of the nation or the world. They transfer money by checks. Now that's the way it used to be. As I say, we have to take the way in which Mr. Armstrong was being guided by the Spirit of God, looking at the things as were in his day. I'm going to take that same spirit, that identical lead of the Spirit of Christ, quite frankly, and let it lead us today into the analysis and the correct analysis of the situation that we find ourselves in and what we are looking at in the world today. But he says, and you have a system whereby someone writes a check, for example, in Philadelphia, and he has an account in the bank here in Pasadena. That check has got to get somewhere, somehow, from Philadelphia, where he cashes it in the store or something there, to come here, and the money has to come out of his account in this bank and be transferred back. And so a correspondent bank system was invented, and has been going long before I was born. And that's the banking system. And that's the way it is today, still. It's based on this system of exchange of money. He then comments about various banks that he knew in Chicago and in Iowa, and he says, when a bank of that size collapses and people begin to lose confidence in the bank and there's a run on the bank, everyone tries to draw their money out. The bank never has as much cash on hand as it has deposits that it owes to depositors that have deposited their money with it, and they could bankrupt a bank when they start the run on it. And so the bank is so large it would affect all, and if the banker's bank and banks all over the United States have to keep the money on deposit in that bank for the clearing of checks, and that would upset the whole banking system of the United States, and so government had to come to the aid of the banks. So basically, if there's a run on the banks and people want their money out of the bank, then you're going to have problems. And this system that has been devised comes perilously close to completely collapsing, and the banking, the banks close, quite frankly. They close the door. They can't cope with it anymore. Now, that's fine for the present system that we've got. But you see, what will then happen, and this is what is the reason for the sermon, looking at the present position, we've got negative interest rates today. So people are going to say, well, hang on a minute, what am I leaving my money in the bank for when I'm going to have a safe? You know, spend some of the money for a safe and put the safe somewhere safe and put the money in there and not lose money by having to pay for the privilege of storing the cash and have that cash available. And also the danger, quite frankly, of this banking holiday, the bank holiday that would occur if the run on the banks occurred. And you suddenly find that instead of £100,000, you're only left with £50,000 in your bank account. And the rest is given to you as bank shares. And that's a real possibility, quite serious possibility. So people are looking at the things, the run on the banks and the negative interest rates that they're seeing. And you say, well, what's going to happen, therefore, thereafter? What's it going to lead into? And I think that in what you can read, this is from the Telegraph back in 2015, about a year ago. It says, in this futuristic world, this is called how to end boom on bust. And the solution is to make cash illegal. Now you think about that a little bit. You get cash illegal, what does it do? It means you can't have a run on the bank, because you can't get your cash out. It's not your cash. It's merely the movement of money. Mobile phone, credit cards and so on. You cannot go. What are you going to put it into? You can't get it out. It's impossible. So with one piece of legislation, they can cut the entire danger out of the way. Now they're looking at this as a future system anyway, but they're looking decades ahead. But if there is a crisis and there is a run on the banks, this system is likely to come in. We might have chaos for 6 months, and when it's got complete control, which again fits in with prophecy. It fits in with prophecy regarding the mark of the beast. And so this was appeared in the about a year ago in the Telegraph. How to end the boom or bust, make cash illegal. In this futuristic world, all payments are made by contactless card, mobile phone apps and other electronic means, while notes and coins are abolished. Your current account will no longer be held with a bank, but with the government or the central bank. Now notice that. It's not your money. It's a movement of money, that's all it is. Banks still exist and still lend money, but they get their funds from the central bank, not from depositors. The money that they get is always from a central bank. It's all been centralized. If this sounds rather fanciful, negative interest rates already exist in Denmark, where the central bank charges depositors 0.75% a year, and in Switzerland. At the moment, it's easy for individuals to avoid seeing their money eroded this way. They can simply hold banknotes stored either in a safe or under the proverbial mattress. But if notes and coins are abolished, and the only way to hold money was through a government-controlled bank, there would be no escape. And if they've got a run on the bank, that's what's going to happen. You can guarantee that's what would happen. Another one, this is from Blacklisted News, comment on this system. This is from couple of years ago. It says, in a cashless system, however, an enormous amount of trust is placed in the hand of the government agencies, the banks and the corporations that would then control the money for the convenience, in quotes, of the unwitting soul that sacrifices his own personal responsibility and control for the luxury of his convenience. If even one of these institutions decide for whatever reason that an account of the user should be frozen, disconnected or discontinued, the ability to purchase the basic necessities will disappear. That is, it will disappear if there is no longer the option of cash. And you see the mark of the beast. You can see the mark of the beast and the way in which it's likely to come in. This is where I say, what lessons do you and I have to learn out of this? Because the chances are we're going to have to live through it. When the banks close their doors and we find ourselves not with the savings we thought we had. Well, what lessons do we have to learn? How can we therefore teach? What aversion therapy do we have to learn from? It says, when all financial transactions eventually become digital, it's only a matter of time before banks, corporations and governments begin to force citizens to bend to their will with the threat of cutting off accounts as punishment for resistance or refusal. And as I say, look at the mark of the beast, and that's exactly what is talking about. And without banning cash, I don't see how they could accomplish that. Not really. Now, the reason why I bring that out today is because, dated the 3rd of May 2016, i.e. just a few days ago, there's a report here from Salt Lake Tribune regarding a meeting that took place, inside a secret meeting where Wall Street tested digital cash. This digital cash actually was tested electronically in April, about a month ago anyway. It says, on a recent Monday in April, more than 100 executives from some of the world's largest financial institutions gathered for a private meeting at the Times Square office in NASDAQ. They weren't there just to talk about blockchain, the new technology some predict will transform finance, but to build and experiment with the software. By the end of the day, they had seen something revolutionary: US dollars transformed into pure digital assets, being able to be able to use to execute and settle a trade instantly. There's some great, marvellous benefits to this. It would be presented in marvellous benefits, but played under no illusion. The control will come away from the individual, and it'll be in the hands of central government. And when that happens, it'll happen probably as a result of a banking crash, the result of what Mr. Armstrong was talking about. That's the promise of a blockchain, where the cumbersome and error-prone system that takes days to move money across town or around the world is replaced with almost instant certainty. And that took place about a month ago. They've tested it. And that was about 100 institutions altogether, or 100 executives from all the various major large institutions. So why are they doing it? What are they testing it for? Well, they know that that's what is the direction that everything is going in. As I say, if there is a banking crash, then that will be the result of it. But it could take 6 months of chaos. So what are we having to learn? First of all, turn over to John chapter 10. John chapter 10, let's understand something. The thing that we're going to have to learn is certainly aversion therapy as to the present system. In John chapter 10, verse 7, it says, "Truly," then said Jesus unto them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, that I am the door of the sheep, and we are those sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep didn't hear them." Now, Christ is going to return. And he's not just talking about when he came the first time, he's talking about when he came, comes the second time, and all that came before me, and all the banking systems that came before him at that time have been what? Have been thieves and robbers. But the sheep don't hear them. We've got to learn a different way. We've got to learn from the aversion therapy of having seen the system collapse. But the different way is a different mindset. It's an outgoing mindset, a loving mindset, which the banking system ain't, quite frankly. "I am the door. By me, if any man enters in, then he shall be saved, and go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy, but I am come that they may have life, and they may have it more abundantly." And that is true also, life, and more abundantly, in the economic sphere as well. The economic sphere, as far as the world is concerned, and also out into eternity, the same thing applies. And yet today, what do we got? We've got quantitative easing, printing money, basically, which is invariably going to lead to inflation. And if the banking system is under pressure, people will be wanting their money out. I mean, many in this room can't remember probably the inflation at 27%. And you know, Adele and I certainly can. You remember 27% back in the 70s. And that's the way it was. And we had to live within this. And then the mortgages were in the 30s and 40s of percent. Horrendous interest rates. And based on spiritual greed, as Babson pointed out, you know, when you get righteousness suffering, then you've got problems in the financial area, because it is based on spiritual greed. But money itself is really, it's a worldly illusion. interesting thing is, if you turn over to Revelation 3, I want you to point out something, just notice something in Revelation 3. That there does seem to be a problem at the end time with the church at the end time, with the thinking of the church at the end time. Because here in Revelation chapter 3, it says in verse 17, it says, because you say I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and you don't know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, naked. Now yes, he's talking about spiritually, the way the church that becomes Laodicea is going to be painted. It's painted here by God, by Christ. But notice what is being said. It says, I'm rich and increased with goods. They have a distorted view. They're bought into, 1 Timothy 6, verse 10, talks about the love of money being a root cause of all kinds of evil. And it's talking about the problem in there, in that particular verse. He's talking about problems within the church. If our view is wrong, if our view and take on the situation is wrong, then it will take us in an evil direction. And the individuals here that will form part of the Laodicean church, and we don't know who these people are, we don't know who these people are as yet, but until one group is left behind and one group flees or is taken, at that point we will then know who they are. But the characteristics are all around us today, and they seem to have bought into this love of money, rich and increased with goods, having taken on board the world's way of looking at things. Turn over to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, let's pick it up in verse 15. And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. That's the lesson that is needed to learn, for all of us, quite frankly. A man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. And he spoke a parable to them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, what am I going to do, because I have no room to bestow my fruits? And he said, this I'll do, I'll pull down my barns, I'll build greater, and there I'll bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have much goods laid up for many years, take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Now at least he had something real to show for it. But in most cases these days, there's not even anything real to show for it. But God said to him, you fool! This night your soul will be required of you, and where shall those things be which you have now provided? So it is he that lays up treasure for himself, and is not rich towards God. So ultimately, even if we put money into something tangible, into something real, ultimately we die and we lose it. What about King Tutankhamun? How long did it take him? I'd imagine it took him all his life, quite frankly, to amass what he amassed and to work towards his eventual death. I mean, he was a boy king, but he and his father, or exactly what history is, I haven't actually gone ahead and studied his life, but you don't put that amount of wealth together overnight. It's something that had been planned. And yet he dies, and when he is resurrected, he has nothing. Nothing at all. Total financial crash. Total financial crash. And ultimately, all of us will go through that. We came with nothing into the world, we'll leave with nothing taken from this world. And Isaiah chapter 2. But there are more important things than money. You wouldn't think so. We watched a sitcom, Terry and June, the other night, and they won so much on the national not National Lottery, Premium Bonds, that's right, Premium Bonds. Premium Bond came up for £250,000, which back in the 70s when it was aired was an awful lot of money. And suddenly you see all these hangers-on appear out of the woodwork. They probably spent the money about five times over by the time the programme finished. Inevitably, they didn't have the money anyway, so it was a mistake. So, but here in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 11, it says, "The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day." That's the eventual state of affairs. You know, God owns all the wealth. We have it for a short time during our life. And even if we hoard it and store it up and reckon we're going to have it in the afterlife, we're not. We're simply not. And in verse 17, "And the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be made low, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day, and the idols shall be utterly abolished." And let's face it, finance and money is an idol to so many. "And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth, for fear of the Eternal and for the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake terribly the earth. In that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold." And even if it's an ingot, it's still not going to survive. "Which they made each one for himself to worship in the moles and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rocks for the fear of the Eternal and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake terribly the earth. Cease from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?" That's the truth of the matter. And the money is literally a worldly illusion. It's based on debt. There's nothing actually there. Quantitative easing is simply printing. They don't even print it anymore. They simply concoct it. They say, right, we're going to have so much, add so many trillions to the national debt. But the key thing is what? What is the key thing that we need to learn? The key thing that God has given us within the use of money? Well, it's the character that's produced. And how does that character produced? Well, it's how we spend that money, what we do with it, how we use it. It's the doing, it's the using, it's the how we conduct ourselves. That's what's key, and it's absolutely key for all of us. It's what we do with it and how we use it in a wise and worthwhile manner. And the wealth itself is really a side issue. The character is the main thing. And that's something that we lose sight of. And as I say, you're looking at Laodicea as far as... turn over to Haggai. Haggai chapter 1. Haggai chapter 1. He's talking to the church, remember, here. Then came the words in verse 3. Let's go back a little bit. In verse 2 it says, "Thus speaks to the Eternal of hosts, saying, The people say, the time is now that the Eternal's house should be built." And there's been a danger, actually. There's been some speculation about being 3.5 years of peace and safety. When they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them. And there's been speculation that peace and safety is going to last 3.5 years. That is very, very dangerous indeed. Incredibly dangerous. That it's not something that the church ever really believed, as far as I'm concerned. And it says, the indication here is this says, speaks the Eternal of hosts, saying that people say the time is not come the time that the Lord, Eternal's house should be built. And then came the word of the Eternal by the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses, and while this house lays waste? And again, you look in the Laodicea, because you say, I'm rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and don't know that you're rich and miserable, poor, blind and naked. It fits in with that assessment. Now therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways. You sow much, and you bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you're not filled. You clothe yourselves, but you're none's warm. And he that earns wages to put into a bag with holes. And that's exactly what it is like. You're constantly chasing your tail financially. And again, we should be learning from this. We should be learning the character aspects from this frame of mind, from the frame of mind that we see all around us within the world, and not go along the, you know, go down the same frame of mind ourselves. But fiat money is certainly an illusion. But even the fact that we can hang on to it, the fact that we try and hang on to it, that's an illusion itself. It brought out over in Luke chapter 12. But when you're looking at the prophesied direction, we'll turn over to Revelation 13. Revelation 13. Because the prophesied direction is very clear. We're looking at these, the banning of cash, as something that they are planning for at the present time. But as I say, what appears to be the case, looking at it critically, is that this present system will collapse with the run on the banks. And from that run on the banks, the solution to the run on the banks is to get rid of cash. Because if you get rid of cash, you can't have a run on the banks. And they're constantly using stopgap measures. And this would be something which would be major, major. You know, in 2008, they're very, very close to having complete meltdown financially. If and when it happens again, undoubtedly it would be a complete meltdown. The banks would have to close. But here, as it was mentioned before, fish it out, it says, when all financial transactions eventually become digital, it's only a matter of time before banks, corporations and governments begin to force citizens to bend to their will with the threat of cutting off accounts as punishment for resistance or refusal. And here in Revelation 13, let's pick it up in verse 11, it says, I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke as a dragon, and he is the Holy Roman Empire. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and caused the earth, and this first beast was the Roman Empire, and caused the earth and those that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders, so he makes fire come down from heaven into the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound of his sword and did live. And he had the power to give life to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as who would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. There's your compunction. And he causes all, both small, great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or their forehead, into what they think or what they do, their actions. And then no man may buy or sell, except that he had that mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. It's interesting that he says the he not only had the mark of the beast, but also the either the mark of the beast, or the name of the beast, the authority in other words, or the number of his name, or a stamp of approval. And without the stamp of approval, and that presumably would mean that people that are Sabbath keepers would have to be registered in some way and given a an official sanction to their Sabbath keeping. Without that official sanction to the Sabbath keeping, therefore you'll find yourself you wouldn't be able to buy or sell. Could it be that the registration is going to be done on the Sabbath and you're going to have an exemption? And if you get an exemption, you've got your exemption certificate. The Christianity and Muslim threat. You can speculate about exactly how these things are going to be implemented, but something along those lines is going to come. And as Mr. Armstrong said, that he felt that looking at the situation that he was looking at, the trigger appears to be economic. And looking at the situation that we're looking at, the trigger seems to be economic, with a banking collapse and the closure of the banks and a run on the banks and the cashless society then coming out of the mayhem that would ensue. And yet we are going to have to be learning. We have to be learning within this. So that no man may buy or sell except he that had the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. And he goes on to the number of his name being 666. Now the individuals, if you turn over to Revelation 18, the individuals that are going to be affected ultimately, and they will actually mourn the collapse of the beast system. In Revelation 18, verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, out of Babylon, that you are not partakers of her sins, that you receive not of her plagues." So it's essential that we get our thinking not in the Babylonish way, not in Satan's way of get, but in God's way of give, of serve, of help, and even in the financial areas. "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. I reward her even as she rewarded you to a double, fill up a cup, how much she glorified herself. Therefore her plagues shall come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire. And the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment." Well, ultimately, presumably it'll be atomic attack on the beast power nations. And standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, thy great city, Babylon, thy great city, thy great system, thy great financial system included, the mighty city, for in one hour your judgment is come. The merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise any more." So the merchandise no man will be able to buy or sell unless he had the mark of the beast. And eventually, when God takes vengeance on her initially through the eastern armies, and then eventually through his own actions, it's going to be the merchants that will bewail her. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and iPhones and iPods and, you know, on it goes. And notice in verse 15, "The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing." And verse 19, "And they cast dust on their heads, and they cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, the great city in which we were made rich, all that had ships in the sea, by reason of her costliness, for in one hour she's made desolate." And verse 20, "Rejoice over her, you heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. And the mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall thy great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all." So that's the end of her. But notice, I want you to notice just how much the prophesied direction is in direction of merchants, of trade. And the Babylonian system is based and geared around that. So this is what I say, we have to learn from the collapse that will take place. As it says in Isaiah 30, verse 13, it tells you it's going to be like a wall ready to break. It's what Mr. Armstrong brings out as well. He says, "I believe that some event's going to happen suddenly just out of a clear blue sky that is going to shock the whole world and is going to cause the nation of Europe to realize they must unite. But it's something that comes very, very suddenly." Say we see a wall ready to break, and once you hear a slight cracking, but that's about as much as you hear. Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Because within this system, the system which has been based on greed, which we've grown up in, quite frankly, I wonder whether we can even have a wholesome view of finance within today's society. The final understanding and the final level of comprehension, I think, is only going to happen in the future, when Christ returns. It's about the only way in which it's going to take place. But Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, it says, "No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and mammon and physical wealth. Therefore I say to you, take no anxious thought for your life, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, or with your body that you, what you'll put on. Isn't the life more than food, and the body than raiment? Behold, the fowls of the air, they sow not, neither do they reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much better than they?" And these are the kind of words that we need to hang on to and realize that, you know, God is quite able to take care of even birds. Would he not take care of us? Because, you know, when the money that we've if our view is wealth is money in the bank, if that's what our view is, and the banks close their doors, and your money, you don't have any money anymore, and the cash is going to have to be dictated by some beast power, it becomes alarming, to say the least. And yet what they're saying here is, look, your Father understands the problems. He's quite aware what you need. And our view of life, our view of what is necessary, is going to have to change. It's going to have to change dramatically. It's like Tutankhamun. His view of life after his financial collapse and crash, when he finally gets resurrected and realizes all his money is put aside, it's all non-existent, is going to have to change. He's going to have to change dramatically. "Which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit to his stature? And why take you thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow and toil not, neither do they spin. Yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these." We're going to have to go out and just look at the flowers, quite frankly, and believe what God says here. Believe that he's quite capable of decking us and clothing us and looking after us. Because quite frankly, our money is not going to be able to do that. "Therefore, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you of little faith? Therefore, do not become unglued," literally is what it means. Don't become over anxious. Don't become unglued, saying, "What shall we eat, or what are we going to drink, or what are we going to be clothed with? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, the beast power seeks. For all these things the world financial system seeks, which is why they'll bring in a cashless society. For your Father in heaven knows that you have need of all these things." He knows, he understands it. "But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness." Those are the two things. The kingdom of God is to recognize, not only just seeking first what is in the future, but it's brought out in Hebrews 11, that those that say such things declare that they seek another country. What are they declaring? What are they saying? They're actually declaring that they're strangers and pilgrims on the earth. This isn't our world. This isn't our system. This isn't our monetary system. The money in the bank is very, you know, it's good to have, it's necessary for the present distress, but that's not where it's at. Eventually, we may well have to flee and leave the whole lot behind. You know, except what you can actually carry. And what are you going to carry? Gold coins? Platinum? That's not where it's at. That simply is not where it's at. "But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Take therefore no anxious thought," don't become unglued, "for the morrow. For the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." So the answer And the solution, the prophesied direction as far as we are concerned, is to make sure we live in day-tight compartments. When this time comes, take it a day at a time. You know, if you've got food for that day, that's fine. If you've got covering for that day, that's fine. And we're going to have to live in a different society, a different world. And the world around us is going to be going frantic. And every indication is that this is coming. The banks are going to ultimately close their doors, there will be some kind of a crisis, and some kind of cashless society will exist as a result of it. And it is the interim, maybe 6 months, maybe 4 months, maybe 3 months, I don't know. But the interim period that is going to be difficult for everyone. Psalm 37. Verse 1, it says, "Fret not yourself because of evildoers, neither against the workers of iniquity." And let's face it, the banking fraternity, I'm not going to slander them, but I'll say the good percentage there in there somewhere that probably could do with slandering. "But neither be you envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like grass and wither as the green herb." What did Tutankhamun, he was the boy king, what was he, in the 20s when he died? I mean, they soon cut down to wither as a green herb. "But trust in the Eternal and do good, and so shall you dwell in the land, and truly you shall be fed." These are the kind of psalms that we need to keep in mind, we need to hang on to. Verse 7, "Rest in the Eternal and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked devices to pass." And again, a number of these devices, the financial instruments that they've devised are quite frankly wicked. There's no other word for them. Verse 10, "For yet a little while and the wicked shall not be. Yes, you will diligently consider his place, and it shall not be, but the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." And verse 18, "The Eternal knows the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied." Now, forgive me for being so naive, but that sounds like a promise. In the days of famine they shall be satisfied. Verse 21, "The wicked borrows and pays not again, but the righteous shows mercy and gives." It's the way of give and the way of get. And it is the understanding of the aversion therapy that we'll be witnessing, and yet living by a different frame of mind, by a different outgoing attitude of mind. Verse 25, "I've been young, and now I'm old, yet I've not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread." And if we haven't seen the righteous forsaken in the past, it's likely to continue. And over in verse 34, "Wait upon the Eternal and keep his way, and he shall exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you shall see it." You know, it's worth reading the entire psalm, quite frankly, because it focuses on the key issues. That wealth is just a merely a side issue. Character is the key issue. How you use the wealth is what is important. What do you do with the wealth? How do you apply it in the right way? And that is what is important. That is what we're going to have to understand by the prophesied direction. Now, God owns all. He talks about him owning the cattle on a thousand hills. But if we turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. Now, what are we going to have to be teaching? The financial, you know, people that wheel and deal, and they finally die within the tribulation. Because let's face it, 9 out of 10 of people are going to be dead in the tribulation. And so they're resurrected with Tutankhamun and the bankers, and everybody else is resurrected in the future. They have quite frankly stolen. They've not administered their wealth according to God's principles. They've stolen their wealth in a large degree. Let him that stole, in verse 28 of Ephesians 4, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labour. So what are we going to be teaching them? We're teaching them to labour. Yes, to labour, but why? No, rather let them labour, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needs. So he labours to give. I mean, people labour and they burn the candle at both ends. They put the hours in, quite frankly, to go ahead and amass a huge amount of wealth. Yet that doesn't produce the same peace of mind that is necessary. But this is what we will be teaching people in the future. Let's have a look at some of God's rules that undoubtedly will be applied. Turn over to Leviticus 27. Leviticus 27. Now, exactly how the new covenant, the new agreement, the new marriage agreement will work in regards to the financial situation, how much it will mirror what happened in ancient Israel's case, we don't know exactly. But I can tell you this much, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today and forever, and the God is a God that doesn't change. And so it's going to be something very, very similar, whatever the situation is in the future. And we find over in Leviticus 27, and it says in verse 16, and if a man shall sanctify unto the Eternal some part of a field of his possession, then the estimation shall be according to the seed thereof. A homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. Now, it is a seed that is produced by the land. It's talking about the value of a land, and it's talking about the value according to the aroma of barley seed, and it's 50 shekels of silver. And if he sanctifies his field from the year of the Jubilee according to the estimation, it'll stand. If he sanctify the field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall reckon to him the money according to the year. So 50 years is 50 shekels. And every year less, you knock off a shekel for the actual productive nature of that field. So what it's telling us here is that the shekel, the unit of money, is going to be tied somehow to the land, to the barley harvest. And every indication is that what we'll be looking at in the future. Now, if we turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 15, Deuteronomy 15. Not only is there not going to be interest charged, but even the capital sum as well will be forgiven. Deuteronomy 15, let's pick it up in verse 1. It says, at the end of every 7 years you shall make a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lends anything to his neighbour shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbour or of his brother, because it's called the Eternal's release. So this is a sabbatical year. Now, we misguidedly try to apply this the understanding that we had on an agricultural basis, advising farmers to go ahead and every 7 years rest their land and not farm the land on the seventh year. Now, quite frankly, farmers went broke, because there are two parts to the sabbatical year. One is the farm itself, resting your land, and the other is the financial side. And if the farmer has got a mortgage, you don't go ahead and try and apply half a law. It's ridiculous. You can't get that released. But this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lends anything to his neighbour should release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbour, nor of his brother, because it's the Eternal's release. Of a foreigner you may exact it again, but that which is yours with your brother, your hand shall release to this end. It's better translated. that there shall be no poor among you, for the Eternal shall greatly bless you in the land which the Eternal your God gives you for an inheritance to possess it. Now, I know of no real instances where this was universally applied within Israel. It seems as if they struggled with this one. So why is it here? Well, it's here to tell us the way and the direction and the mind of God in these areas. Let's turn over to Leviticus again, Leviticus 25 this time. Because not only are we going to have interest will be banned within Israel, or within the Commonwealth of Israel, but the actual capital sum will be released every 7 years. And in addition to that, when you're looking at Leviticus 25, let's see, my notes are getting shuffled up here. So in Leviticus 25, notice in verse 8, and you shall number 7 Sabbaths of years to you 7 times 7 years, so 7 times 7 sabbatical years. And the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto you 49 years, and you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound in the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement you'll make the trumpet sound throughout all your land, and you'll hallow the 50th year. It's interesting that it's actually on Satan's day, on the Day of Atonement, that they're declaring liberty from this oppressive financial system. And there will be no big corporations. There can be people cooperating together, corporations, but not corporations. And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and you'll return every man to his possession, and you return every man to his family. So not only are we having no interest, and capital sums are forgiven every 7 years, but even if you lose your land, you can't actually lose the land, because it comes back to you. It says in verse 23, it says, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. It's a different relationship altogether. I mean, in India, apparently the debts that people have are passed on to their children, and they exact them from the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and it only goes down. And people are in continual servitude with these horrendous debts that they've passed on. And you notice in verse 17, you shall not therefore oppress one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Eternal, your God. You know, the land of Egypt, they were slaves, and that's a thing of the past. Notice in verse 31, but the houses of the villages which have no wall around about them shall be counted as the fields of the country. They shall be may be redeemed, and they shall go out in the jubilee. So when you're looking at the villages, in the cities, you're able to buy and sell properties, but in a walled city, and after a year, you only redeem it within a year, or it actually gets transferred. But in the country areas, the villages were counted as the fields. So they returned to the families concerned. And what we're looking at as far as God's system is concerned, God's physical wealth system, the wealth is in the land. And the custodians of the land are the families. Now that's totally different from what we've got today. Totally, totally, totally different. But that's the way of God. The wealth is in the land, the custodians are the families, and the families that actually tend that land, look after that land. It's going to be called a land of unwalled villages in the world tomorrow. So Israel is going to be called that, and certainly as that Commonwealth of Israel spreads, so it'll spread far and wide. But the fact is that inheritance of the Jubilee almost certainly will take place, and you've put in your notes Ecclesiastes 5 verse 9. It talks about the king being served from the field. The reality of the situation is that wealth is in the land. Wealth, you know, Bitcoin or this new system that they've come up with. What do they call it? Thing? Blockchain. There's nothing there. It just exists on a computer system. Fiat money is almost the same. I mean, how much, I meant to bring up a £5 note or a £10, £20 note, how much is a £20 note worth? You can't even write on the wretched stuff. It just doesn't, and for other bodily uses as well, it's not very, I'd rather have other paper to use. But no, it's of no value at all. There's nothing there. And yet people go frantic over the creation of this kind of wealth, the holding on to this kind of wealth. Yet in Ecclesiastes 5 verse 9, the king is served by the field. Now it's not that the wealth is wrong, it's not. Isaiah 60 verse 13, again put in your notes, talks about the place of my feet will be glorious. It'll be a glorious, you know, Jerusalem through the millennium will be a glorious location. Fabulous. Wealth will pour in from the outlying areas. The view, however, that we need, and the view that we need to be teaching, as it says in Proverbs 30, verse 8, again, put in your notes, give me neither poverty nor riches. And also in Proverbs 3, verse 9 and 10, it talks about how to honour the Lord with your substance, and so will your barns be filled. Right, the final point then. Turn over to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. What we need to teach in the future, more than anything else, it's not just God's physical wealth, the fact that God's view on physical wealth regarding the wealth being in the land and the custodians of that land in the basic. Which is certainly the way it is found within scriptures. But it goes beyond that, because none of us, absolutely none of us, will take any wealth with us. When we die, and there's severing. And even when we get changed, there's no indication that, you know, even the clothes we stand up in, there'll be clothes given to us, but presumably spirit clothes of some description. But while we're here, the other lessons that we need to learn. It says here in James chapter 4, James 4 verse 13, it says, go to now, you that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Now, we've seen that the beast system is going to be very much based on the merchants of the earth. The mark of the beast is going to be based on our ability to buy and sell. So this is going to be something which is, you know, large within the beast system. But it says in verse 14, it says, whereas you don't know what will be on the morrow. For what is your life? What is our life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Tutankhamun, that's all his life was. All the gold that he hoarded, all the artifacts that he had, the wonderful things that Carter looked at as he opened a tomb, they appeared for a little time and they vanished away. He does not take them with him. For what you ought to say is, if the Lord will, you will live and do this and do that. And it's the doing of it that is so important. It's the doing of it that is vital. I always remember, let's just finish this section off. It says, for that you ought to say, if the Lord will, you shall live and do this or do that. But now you rejoice in your boasting, and all such rejoicing is evil. Therefore, to him that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. I was reading an article the other day in an old Reader's Digest, and it was taken from a book called When Cancer Strikes, and this individual, John MacDonald, he died aged 49. And he mentions about his feelings towards life and how they changed rapidly and markedly by the diagnosis. When I became aware of my imminent mortality, my attitudes changed. There's real meaning to the words, "This is the first day of the rest of your life." There was a heightened awareness of each sunny day, the beauty of flowers, the song of a bird. How often do we reflect on the joy of breathing easily, or swallowing without effort and discomfort, of walking without pain, of a complete and peaceful night's sleep? One realizes how precious life is when it appears certain that it will be curtailed. I thought that was very, very well put. And certainly my experience, my eldest brother died of cancer. He was age 50 when he died. But he, I always remember him saying, when the diagnosis was given to him, he was given 6 months to live. And it was almost exactly 6 months that he had. We managed to visit him fairly regularly in those 6 months. But I always remember him one time saying that what he cherishes more than almost anything else is a tomato. Tomato and bread. Just be able to eat, sit down for tea, and at the end of a decent day, and enjoy a tomato and some bread and butter. And that was what was important. And the view of life, it says, what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. You've got to put the life into its context. Turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And in this, well, he begins, he says, I said in my heart, go to now, I'll prove you, or test you with mirth. I therefore enjoy pleasures, and behold, this also is vanity. And down 8, verse 8, he says, I gathered unto me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces, and I got me men singers and women singers. And Tutankhamun undoubtedly did the same. Undoubtedly, he says, you know, everything glistened with gold when he opened the tomb. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, and the musical instruments, and that of all sorts. And I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labour. Now notice what it says, my heart rejoiced in all my labour. It was the doing of it that was important. It was the doing of it, not the having of it. And this is my portion, and of all my labour, this is the portion. This is what was important. Then I looked on all that the works of my hand had wrought, and all the labour that I had laboured to do, and behold, it was all vanity and vexation of spirit, and there's no profit under the sun. This man had everything, but it was the doing of it that gave him the satisfaction. And that is what we're going to have to teach Tutankhamun and all the others that are resurrected. These are the things of a value. This is what is brought out as to what is of value. Verse 22. For what has a man of all his labour and all the vexation of his heart in which he labours under the sun? For all his days are sorrow and his travail grief, yes, his heart takes not rest in the night. This also is vanity. You look at life that way, you work frantically hard to try and amass as much as possible. You're chasing after the wind. That's all, you know, it's all vanity, it's all emptiness. There is nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. It's the doing of it that is so important. And it's the doing of it, that it actually builds the character. The wealth is a mere side issue. It's how you obtain that wealth, how you expend that wealth, what you do to enjoy that wealth that is important. that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. This is actually coming from God. This is what God has given us. For who can eat, or who can hasten thereunto more than I? In other words, who's going to have more than he can? You're just getting it. It doesn't give anything of lasting value. Okay, a couple of scriptures in closing. Proverbs chapter 3. Because the thing to actually get, and the thing to hang on to, is the character. It is the wisdom that is gained. It is the wisdom in actually handling the money. It is the wisdom in making the money, wisdom of work. And notice in verse 13 of Proverbs 3, happy is the man that finds wisdom, and the man that gets understanding. The wise character, in other words. A wise and understanding character. For the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you can desire are not to be compared to her. That's the value. That's the only thing of value that we take with us. The only thing of value that is going to set people on the right track in the millennium. What we're going to have to be teaching them. There's no problem with the physical wealth. God's view of physical wealth is fine. But it is family-based. It is land-based. But the real value is what you gain in the way of wisdom, in the way of character, in doing what you do in life. Length of days is to her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honour. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life. The tree of life, as far as the understanding was the Holy Spirit. It's the way of the Spirit of God. And you know, God delights in what he does. He is a creator. He's continually creating. She is a tree of life to those that lay hold on her, and happy in every one that retains her. The Eternal by wisdom has founded the earth. By understanding he has established the heavens, and by his knowledge the depths are broken up, and the clouds drop down the dew. So, there's a way of give, there's a way of get, and the physical life character is the key. Character is the key, the wisdom and a wise character. And eventually we're going to have Tutankhamun actually resurrected, and we're going to have to deal with him and point him in the right direction. And we'll have learned through the way we handle financial collapse ourselves. How are we going to handle it? What are we going to do? Are we going to go to pieces? Are we going to, when the money that we thought we had in the bank is no more, are we going to go to become fraught? Or will we handle it properly? Turn over to Luke chapter 16, final scripture. Luke 16, verse 9, it says, "And I say to you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations." So it's not even just character, it's also friends as well. Because if we all find ourselves in the kingdom of God, those friendships will continue for eternity. So that's important. "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust in much." So how we handle our wealth, how we handle our whatever it is that we've been given, is important. We were being judged on that. This is part of the course for life. "If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who is going to give you that which is your own?" And the own being life, eternal life in the kingdom of God, and all that is involved therein. "No servant shall serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other." And this is what we've got to make sure we understand as we go through the problems that are going to come in this world. And understand it in such a way that we will be able to teach it in the future. You can't serve God and mammon being the way the world looks at worldly wealth.